Do this quickly. I hope everybody found the food, found the beverages out there. Feel free to go ahead and eat as we move through this, and we hope to have get through it fairly quickly and leave time for questions and answers. You know, it's interesting that on the timing of this, because I think if any of you looked at the headlines this morning, here we go again. Oil prices, $105 a barrel for domestic oil. Gas prices going up again. And if you go back, and nobody's as old as me in this room, but I remember in the early 70s sitting in gas lines because of our nation's addiction to foreign oil. And if over this past 40 years, how many times have we seen the same movie? Over and over again. Spike in fuel prices, and it has such a tremendous impact on our economy and certainly our citizens. And you know, this is in an era when the rhetoric coming from the other side is, you know, we got all this oil. We're drilling all this oil. We're finding new ways. We don't need the renewable fuel standard. Well, I think this morning's headline is just another good example of yes, we do. Yes, we need a competitive alternative to fossil-based fuel. And that's what our industries do. Let me start here. Erebus?
Yes.
And first, maybe I should say something about Fuels America. It's a coalition that's put together to defend the RFS and educate people about the benefits of the RFS and higher blends of renewable fuels. We represent a variety of enterprises that everything from grain-based ethanol to next generation and all the way through the process. It's people that understand, obviously, the benefits of what we seek to accomplish. Do we want alternatives to oil? I think everyone would probably say yes, unless you work for the oil industry. It would be a resounding yes. A recent poll done by Fuels America Commission found that 75% want more renewable fuel options at the gas stations. That's been a big challenge on us being able to have access to the consumer that we'll hear from our panelists here later today. 60%, 3 in 5, blame the oil industry for high gas prices. You know, we hear this over and over again. Well, it's because we shut down some plants for maintenance a few weeks before the biggest driving demand season of the year. We hear, oh, well, it's because of turmoil in the Middle East. Well, I don't know how many times we've heard that over and over again, and regardless of the cause, let's fix it. What's the alternative? We'll spend a lot of time talking about that. And 73% of the respondents favor the renewable fuel standard. Interesting enough, that same poll, it's not on this chart, asked consumers how they were coping and how they would cope with higher gas prices. Over 50% said they would take less trips, less vacations, driving road trips to see friends or family. Others, about a third, said they were cut back on going out to eat. But interesting enough, 6% said they would cut their air conditioning at home to be able to cope. There's a lot of people out there on fixed incomes, elderly. There are a lot of people that don't have access to urban transit, transportation programs that rely on getting to work, getting to church, getting to the grocery store, and that hits them hard. Energy independence, we've talked about this forever. The U.S. uses almost 20 million barrels of oil per day. And regardless of how much oil we drill at home, the price of fuel is dictated by global markets controlled by external forces, and there is this little monopoly called OPEC. The IEA has reported that oil prices will continue to rise in the coming years, reaching $125 a barrel. American families paid the highest percent of household income for gas expenditures that were paid in nearly three decades, February 2013. and renewable fuel reduces gas prices, saving American families about $1,200 a year in 2011. The environmental benefits, if you want to draw a comparison, the greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels account for about 31% of the U.S. CO2 emissions from fossil fuel combustion. 65% of those emissions stem from gasoline consumption for personal vehicle use. And to address this, obviously, we need to reduce our consumption of oil, regardless of where it's produced. The RFS basics, I don't know how many people know what the Renewable Fuel Standard is. It's getting a lot more play today, so more and more people are becoming familiar. It was created in 2005 with very modest volume targets. In 2007, it was expanded and included in the Energy Independence and Security Act, calling for a goal of 36 billion gallons of renewable fuel to be produced by 2022. Specific blending targets are included for different types of fuel. You got ethanol, you got cellulose, you got biodiesel, you have advanced buckets. And these individual fuels have to be approved by EPA for use. And once approved, are blended with traditional gasoline to provide a cleaner product at the pump. The targets are adjustable, meaning EPA has the flexibility to adjust those targets on an annual basis, and each of the last 3 years has done so. There are multiple compliance mechanisms on blending the renewable fuel, buying credits, so they gave market flexibility at the obligated parties' insistence in the original act. The EPA just finished the rule on the RFS2 in 2010. We're basically just one-third of the way through a 15-year national energy plan. And as many of you know, there's some out there that want to pull the plug prematurely. The market, why this policy? One, the markets. Two, eliminate monopoly conditions. Remember, that price of oil is often set by the monopoly called OPEC. Stable policy for investment gave 15 years for people to invest and build out the infrastructure, the biorefineries, the transportation networks, everything involved. And so it gave certainty that time would be there for people to invest and make this happen. It was flexible, recognized shifting conditions with the flexibility provided to EPA, and it drove progress towards lower carbon fuels. The investment all depends upon that policy stability. So all this talk of eliminating the RFS, as API and the refiners have called for, does not create a stable marketplace, and that's why it's so important to us. U.S. transportation fuel markets diversifying. The policy is working. We're 10% of their fuel supply. We are accountable for up to close to 400,000 direct and indirect jobs that have been created in the industry. The first generation has been very successful. The grain-based corn and sorghum biodiesel is coming. Advanced is growing. Domestic advanced is growing. Certainly cellulose, commercialization of cellulose is just a few months away. There are plants that are being built. We have the availability, and you'll hear from some a retailer here today about higher blends that are approved and are marketed out there. We have the vehicles that can burn higher blends. There's about 12 million flex fuel vehicles, which can burn anything from E0 up to E85. There are Ford and General Motors. All their cars that are manufactured today are warranted for E15. Here's a map of where some of the cellulosic facilities are being built. There's a couple in Iowa that are using what we call corn stover. Cobb's a stalk, a the husk or part of that that comes off the cornfield to make cellulose. And they're both scheduled to be up and running, I think, in the first quarter of next year. We save consumers at the pump. And so with all the rhetoric about high gas prices, and the fact of the matter is ethanol sells for roughly, probably on average, 50 cents a gallon, less than unleaded gasoline. In 2011, according to the LSU study, save consumers 83 cents a gallon at the pump. Renewable fuels, a critical piece of the solution to climate change. The RFS set ambitious targets for production of cellulose in advance. And those advance must meet a 60% greenhouse gas emissions reduction to qualify as an advanced fuel. And cellulose is much higher. And the IEA has even called for a doubling of global biofuels production by 2020 as an effort to avoid a 2-degree cellulose scenario. What's driving all this criticism? I think this slide pretty well says it all. Follow the money. Anybody ever read the book about Watergate and see the movie? And you find out where people are. And they don't make ethanol, so they're not really happy about making E15. They want to do is make gasoline because that's where they make money off of. And this is an oil analyst on Fox recently. Food prices. I've been in Washington way too long, 25, 26 years, but I've heard some pretty big tall tales in this town before, but the biggest lie I've ever heard is the food versus fuel. The facts just don't support it. And most recently, even the World Bank, that initially when all this hullabaloo food versus fuel, which was created by a multi-million dollar PR campaign designed by people who wanted to buy corn cheaper back in 2007 and 2008, came out with this, even the World Bank and others, it's the biofuels. But since people have actually studied and analyzed this, and the biggest driver of food costs is energy. And if you stop and think about it, food travels a long distance before it gets to the consumer. It has to be stored. It has to be distributed. A lot of it has to be refrigerated. It has to be wrapped. It has to be processed. It's all very energy intensive. And the biggest driver, and if you go to USDA or go to any of our group's websites, you'll see the USDA data that only 14 cents out of that consumer dollar goes for the raw commodity. And that's back to the farmer. And that's in the aggregate. That's of all food products. The rest is being passed on. Obviously, the cost of salaries, employees, health care, profits, you name it, are part of that 86 cents that the retailers keep. The renewable fuel is not driving up the corn prices. You can read this EPA analysis. Back in last year, when everybody was crying, oh my gosh, you got to cut back the RFS is causing food prices to go up with the drought. It wasn't the case. And again, while people petitioned to have a waiver of the RFS, they couldn't demonstrate that the RFS was the driving force and causing economic harm. And it hasn't. But as many of you know, in this town and elsewhere, facts sometimes get overlooked. So that's what's really happening. From a big perspective, and this time I want to turn it over to someone who's a real expert on engines. And you hear a lot of rhetoric about, oh my gosh, this ethanol is not good for engines or anything. But Dr. Andy Randolph who's the director of engine technology for Richard Childress Racing. And I don't know if there are any racing fans in here, but they are at the top of the top in terms of race teams. They put a lot of effort into making sure those cars, A, run fast and last. so that they're first across the line. We have partnered with NASCAR. Every car and truck in their top three series has been running on E15 for the last 2.5 seasons. Over 4 million competitive miles, zero problems. Zero problems. And as Andy can tell you, the addition of E15 gained him horsepower. And in racing, everybody likes higher performance. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Andy Denson.
Looks like the NASCAR pit stop.
15 seconds. Here we go.
Thank you, Tom, and it's quite an honor to be here. Thank you all for attending. Certainly welcome the opportunity to talk to you and go racing with you here for about 10 minutes. What I'd like to do is relay to you our experiences in NASCAR over the last 2.5 years since we adopted E15 fuel. Before I do that, give you a little background on ECR engines and what we do. We're a factory-supported team from General Motors building engines for a variety of series, including the top three series in NASCAR. We develop and manufacture high-performance racing engines. We have roughly 125 enthusiasts in our company that produces over 600 engines annually. And we've won, in our history, we've won over 300 races and 15 championships. I realize all of you are NASCAR fans, so you all will recognize the iconic Black 3 and Dale Earnhardt's name. Currently, Kevin Harvick, Jeff Burton, Kurt Busch, a number of people racing in NASCAR use engines developed and manufactured by ECR. A Sprint Cup engine, which is the premier racing engine in the U.S., it's a 5.8-liter small block Chevy-based, production-based engine. Produces 850 horsepower at 9,200 RPM. It's highly dependent on favorable fuel and lubricant properties. It has extreme internal forces. Let me show you a short video here. It'll give you an idea of what we're talking about. Let's see if this works. This will be neat.
Over 333 degrees, pull it out. 116 PSI in the block.
Okay, now that's a bad day when that happens. And obviously that's not something that we like to happen, and we were doing that test, and I had a feeling we might have some bad things happen, so I said, let's fire up a video camera. But if you heard, we were running at over 330 degrees of water temperature, which is pretty darn hot, a little higher than what you will want to achieve in your passenger car engine, and we push the limits in these. We push the limits from a power standpoint, from a speed standpoint. Forces are very, very high. Give you an idea of fuel history in NASCAR. For many years, the NASCAR spec fuel was a leaded aviation fuel. It was 112 octane. And this lasted long beyond when leaded fuel disappeared from the passenger car engine scene. We did that because we require the high octane in these engines to get the performance levels that we do. In 2008, they were in contact with fuel all the time, and you know, contacting leaded fuel was something that we were not too excited about from working in the industry. So in 2008, NASCAR adopted an unleaded fuel, a 98 octane fuel. That higher octane was achieved by over 40% aromatic concentration in the fuel. And aromatics, I don't know if you're familiar, maybe you're not all chemists, but aromatics are benzenes, toluenes. They're very energy density, very high energy density fuels, but they're also very carcinogenic. So instead of struggling with lead poisoning now, we were all catching cancer. So we weren't too happy with that idea either. Then in 2011, NASCAR changed to an E15 fuel, also 98 octane. And the first thing that we really liked about E15 is now we're achieving the octane because of the high ethanol, because of the ethanol content, the high octane that's associated with ethanol. The aromatic concentration of the fuel was more than cut in half. And we really liked that from a safety standpoint. But of course, as soon as we made that move, you know, from people outside the industry and even a few people inside, we heard all these, uh-oh, you're going to have your gaskets are all going to corrode, and your metal's going to degrade, and you're going to have engine failures. And the one that we kept hearing about was water contamination, and how we were going to have so much problem with water contamination in the pool, in the fuel. So I decided to do a little bench experiment. This is pretty easy. Feel free to do this at home, too. So let me show you a couple more videos. You're going to figure out that we're not Hollywood in NASCAR, but you'll get the point here. Let's try this one first.
This is a beaker that has a little over 1,200 cc's E15 fuel directly out of our fuel tank. Should be dry. We're going to go ahead and add 9 cc's of water to it. The 9 cc's of water represents 3/4 of a percent water concentration. You can see as we add the water, it goes right to the bottom of the beaker. It doesn't immediately mix in with the fuel. But if you look real closely, you'll see where the water is starting to soak in with the fuel at the bottom. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take this beaker off of here. I'm going to leave you for a minute. I'll come back when we're ready to stir the water in. Here we are with the water in the beaker, 3/4 of 1%. We're going to go ahead and stir it up now. It's not that easy to get it into solution. It's going to stir pretty good. As you can see, as it keeps on stirring, the fuel starts to look like it's getting a little bit opaque. But then it clears up again, and voila, all the water has gone into solution. That's 3/4% of water before it stops stirring.
Okay, so we thought that was pretty neat, that we heard all these doomsday about getting water in the fuel is going to do really bad things. We put water in the fuel, we stirred it up, and the water all got absorbed in the fuel. You know, sure enough, if you keep adding water to the fuel, eventually you'll get to a point where the fuel is saturated and can't handle any more water. And then the water, then things will start to come out, and you'll get phase separation in the fuel. But as you can see, you can add a fair amount of water and that not happen. Then we said, okay, let's try the same experiment on gasoline. So let's see what happened when we did that. This is a beaker filled with 1,200 cc's of Sunoco 260 GTX, which is a premium gasoline, a hydrocarbon gasoline without any alcohol content. We're going to add 9 cc's of water now and see what happens. You can see as the water is added, just as it did with the E15, the water goes directly to the bottom of the beaker because it's heavier than the gasoline. Now let's go ahead and stir it, see if we can get it to go into solution. Now if you recall, when we did this with the E15, the gasoline immediately started to go into solution as the fuel became translucent, and then when it was totally into solution, the fuel, once again, there was no phase separation between the water and the fuel. The water stopped stirring now. You can see here, as soon as he stops stirring, the water is still out of solution and at the bottom of the beaker. So no matter how long he stirs, the water is not going to dissolve into the gasoline. Thus, you're going to have phase separation immediately as soon as you get any water into the fuel. So we thought that was pretty interesting, and that as soon as you get any water, of course, into gasoline, it goes right to the bottom of the tank and it sits there, and you can stir it till you're blue in the face, and you're still going to have water in your gasoline. So all of a sudden, we weren't so much worried about water or ethanol anymore, and as it says here, it's really proven to be a non-issue. We never have had any problems, and if you do have any condensation of air in the tank or whatever that gets a little water in the fuel, it soaks in, which is very nice. As I said, we heard doomsday claims of the impact of ethanol, but my personal background as a chemist helped me realize immediately that many of the claims didn't make sense from a fundamental engineering perspective. So we just closed our eyes and went forward, and like I said, we really haven't had any problems. I have found it interesting that the vast majority of fuel additives for treating gasoline alcohol blends contain primarily alcohol. If you look into the ingredients on what's on them, all you're doing is adding more alcohol. They're either methanol or an isopropyl alcohol. And when you go in and get your little fuel treatment at the gas station for injector cleaning, or, oh, I got water in my fuel, what am I going to do? You pour alcohol in it. So it's kind of an interesting fact that maybe many of you didn't realize. So our observations from a fuel standpoint, first of all, conversion to E15 fuel was seamless. Zero base engine modifications were required. Our engine power increased slightly. Burn rate, spark timing, was not impacted. And that's important because that comes down to the calibration of the vehicle as far as how you the spark timing is a parameter on how the engine's going to run, and you don't want that to be sensitive to the fuel that you're putting in it. It was not sensitive to it. Post-race piston hardness increased. E15 fuel provides more cooling than previous fuels without ethanol, so that when you're running extended periods of time at wide open throttle like we do, it's nice to get a little cooling out of the fuel to help keep the parts as robust as you want them to be. Deposit buildup was reduced. E15 is less prone to carbon formation in the combustion chamber surfaces and in the exhaust ports. And that's because of the oxygenate that's in the fuel now. It helps oxidize these carbon formations that you get on the chamber surfaces. Like I said, in our experiences, we've had over 3 million miles of crude now. These are just for our engines. NASCAR as a whole, a lot more than this. Had over 3 million miles of crude in race conditions with zero mechanical issues attributed to E15. And we have tested up to 30% ethanol and not seen any incident. So that's our experience from NASCAR. Once again, thank you all for having me. Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, Andy. Anyone who has any questions for him, if we could hold him until the end. Our next panelist is Brent Erickson. Brent's the executive director of Bio, which represents a number of companies that are investing in all sorts of biotechnology into the future and with future generations of fuel. And I'll tell you a little secret about Brent. He actually used to work for American Petroleum Institute, and he has seen the light. So let's all welcome that conversion. Congratulations.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here today. When you all think about biofuels, how many of you think about biotechnology? Biotechnology is used in production of most of our biofuels today. And when you think about oil and petroleum, do you think about that as a biofuel? Because it's the original biofuel. It was the ancient plants and animals that nature buried in the earth and took millions of years to convert to biofuel. But we're using biotechnology today to make new, cleaner fuels and to make them faster and better. Let's see. So BIO is the world's largest biotech trade association, and these are some of the companies that are members of our industrial environmental section that are involved in biofuels and renewable chemical products. I like to think about the corollaries that are happening in the biofuels industry today. If you think about the cell phone and how we evolved from the dial phone to the old brick phone, maybe some of you remember the old brick phone, to the iPhones that we have today, we're seeing a similar evolution in the biofuels industry. So conventional ethanol was the beginning, the foundational part of the biofuels industry, and now we have companies that have developed biotech enzymes to convert cellulosic plant matter to ethanol, and we have companies using algae and other processes to make drop-in biofuels and advanced biofuels and renewable chemicals. So our vision is that we'll have someday biorefineries all across the country that are like oil refineries, and they bring agriculture feedstocks in and make a multiple product just like an oil refinery does. And the RFS is important because that's speeding up the development of those biorefineries. Now, we've heard a lot of talk about cellulosic ethanol, and some people in the oil industry say they're not real. But they are, and they're being commercialized as we speak. Keyor on June 28th announced the start of regular shipments of cellulosic biodiesel from Columbus, Mississippi, and they also recorded sales in November of 2012 and March 2013. The DuPont has a facility under construction in Nevada, Iowa that will be finished soon. Chemtex and Beta Renewables is operating a commercial facility in Jacinto, Italy, and they're planning a new facility in North Carolina. And POET and DSM are on track to complete construction of their facility by 2013. Some other examples are Abengoa Bioenergy. They're building a plant in Hugoton, Kansas that should be in production by the end of 2013 or early 2014. And they've also announced the startup of a production facility in Salamanca, Spain, at their cellulosic demonstration facility there. Another one is Eneos New Planet Bioenergy in Vero Beach, Florida. They are actually commissioning this plant as we speak, and they're using municipal solid waste. What they're using for a feedstock is the old dead citrus trees that are around this area to start with, and they should be turning on the spigot and producing gallons within the next couple of months. So these things are real. And the renewable fuels standard, as I suggested before, is also driving innovation for other fuel molecules and driving biotech innovation. And these technologies are being commercialized as well. So if you think about all the technologies that could produce different biofuel molecules, if you look across the United States, it's a very geographically diverse situation that we have evolving. This is really a sea change in biorefining that's been brought about by the RFS. We still do face some challenges, and one of the biggest challenges for advanced biofuels companies is EPA's slowness in approving new pathways. So it's very hard for companies to get financing if they don't have a pathway approval, and the pathway approval has to do with the feedstock. And today, EPA just announced, for instance, a final rule on the giant reed, Rhododendron and sweet sorghum. So they are making some progress, but they need to speed up the pathway approvals so we can move more quickly to these advanced biofuels. And so what's the alternative? The alternative is more heavy oil from Canada, and more greenhouse gas emissions. What we see is that the price of oil is really pegged on the international price of oil, and OPEC helps set that. So as oil goes up and gas prices go up, it's actually killing demand for gasoline, and that's part of this cause of the blend wall, the so-called blend wall, which really the oil companies have come up with that term. It's more of a speed bump than a blend wall. As we move forward, I found this cartoon on the RFA website, and I thought it was very illustrative because it's really about the oil companies throwing up barriers to biofuels. They've manufactured the blend wall, and they're throwing up barriers. So we hope that we can keep the RFS in place and keep commercializing these advanced biofuels, because if we repeal the RFS now, we'd be strangling the baby in the cradle. These advanced biofuels are just coming online this year, so we need to keep the RFS in place going forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Brent. Before I introduce our next panelists, I do want to thank both Representative Lee Terry and Representative Bruce Braley for hosting this series of briefings today. And I don't know if their staff are in here today, but we should give them a big round of applause. Our next panelist is Bruce Volan, and Bruce comes from Baltic, South Dakota. And you hear all this criticism perpetuated by some, we're just making it up, but they say consumers don't want higher blends of ethanol. Consumers reject this. Well, where the consumer has been offered the higher blends, they like it, and here today to present with us is a real live retailer who runs a C-store, gas station, and repair shop in Baltic, South Dakota. He's got a flex pump out there that offers consumers E15, E30, E85, and here to tell about how that's worked for him in their area, Bruce Fuller. Give Bruce a big round of applause.
Thank you, Tom. No fancy slides or good shows. You just get to look at me here. As he said, I come from Baltic, South Dakota. Small family-owned business, pretty static. How we began before we did our blenders. Business is kind of a brutal creature out there. You know, you're kind of in this buyer be bought world. We were not anywhere near either or, you know, just kind of cavitating on our own, trying to stay alive. And with, you know, a lot of farmers in our area, that's kind of our mainstay. I can look out any door or walk out any door of our station and essentially see a cornfield. I mean, we are literally out in the middle of the country. So with that said, we started getting some pressure from the customers, you know, and we knew we needed to do something to update. Essentially, it was just, as far as employees go, it was my parents and myself and one part-timer. So you're talking real small business here. And it was a bit of a leap of faith. In 07, we just decided to pull the trigger, spend some real money, and update our facility and put in our blender pumps. We really wanted to, E85 was kind of a big deal. And, you know, flex fuel vehicles were getting pretty prevalent. So that is something that we wanted to focus on. As far as not having to change a lot of infrastructure, you know, tanks, piping, it made perfect sense to utilize what we had to put in new dispensers and put our blenders in. And so that's what we did. We kind of embarked on it end of the year in 07. And for us, it's a nice feeling that you can, you know, we deliver bulk gas and fuels. You know, so like I said, we got a lot of pressure, but it's nice for the consumer who is potentially a producer to see this thing come full circle. I mean, they produce the corn, it goes to the plant, I pick up the ethanol, I put it in the tank, they burn it. It's something that's probably pretty hard to describe to a lot of people maybe out here, but in the heartland, it's something that's pretty near and dear to these people. We turned these blenders on, I think, in late October, early November of 07, and instantly seen a twofold increase in our gallons. You know, it was a pretty scary thing to do, because this meant borrowing some money, really kind of putting ourselves out there. And just the increase in the volume alone, you know, made perfect sense. As you know, in the profitability standpoint, we did not stand to make any more than the next guy down the street with a gas station. I mean, if you're going to sell E0 and E10, guess what? You're dictated by your competition. And everybody knows in the fuel world, the only thing that's going to sell gas is price. People are very price conscious when it comes to gas. So with that said, being able to blend our own gave us a bit of a competitive advantage, just strictly due to the numbers, the cost of the gas, the cost of the ethanol, and being able to blend it. You know, so that helps offset the cost of the blenders. The blenders versus conventional pumps, I think when we did it, you could probably buy a conventional pump for somewhere in that $12,000 to $14,000. We spent $18,000 on each blending dispenser. But by all means, it's something that I would certainly do over and over again. So for probably nearly 3 years before implementation, you know, we'd heard about E15. And of course, being a retailer that's seen what we sold was E10, E20, E30, and E85, I knew what giving people these choices could do for us. So obviously I wanted to be on the forefront of this E15 thing, and trust me, it was way more painful for me as a retailer than anybody else that was just wanting to buy the product. Every time we seemed to get a little closer to resolving the issues with E15, another speed bump would come up along the way, and whomever would have to fight through that. So anyway, about a year ago in June, we'd done all of our due diligence with EPA, had our pumps labeled, and we flipped the switch on our E15. We took out our E20 blend, and actually it doesn't sound like it makes a lot of sense. Why would you take E20 out to sell 5% less ethanol? But the E20 was a very slow mover. People that were buying the 20% obviously were probably going to move up to the 30%, and that's why it was so slow. Within weeks, our E15 became our number two seller. And now with about 13 months worth of history behind us, it stayed very solid, and that's and I guess, you know, with just having no expense even in the conversion. If you have a blender pump and you want to convert your, if you're tired of your E10 or your E20 or E30 and you want to put that E15 in, it's as simple as going out to your gas pump with a remote control that looks like something you'd use in your TV, having the correct signage and stickers and labeling, and presto changeo, for near zero expense, we've got E15 implemented into our blender pump. And all of a sudden, now we're selling, being our second best seller of ethanol. I mean, I can't tell you how that just proves to me what the consumer wants. We are definitely a society that demands choices. It's become our nature anymore, and I don't care if you're going to the grocery store or the gas pump. You deserve that chance to buy what you want. And given that choice, it's so obvious that the consumer wants to buy ethanol. Nobody paid me to come up here and to tell you my little story here. I'm just telling you what I know from my personal experience, and honestly, this is 100% truthful. I've tracked this for the last year, from June to June, 12 to 13, my ethanol sales, and now I'm talking percentage of ethanol per gallon of product sold. On a month-to-month basis, I've sold 18 to 28% ethanol, and that's probably dictated on either seasonal, you know, it can be weather. Some people don't like to burn the higher blends when it gets real cold. And a lot of it's dictated, obviously, by pricing. When ethanol's priced right, or when gas is really high or really cheap, you know, that can definitely fluctuate. But nevertheless, the least amount of ethanol I sold in a gallon of gas was 18%. Kind of speaks for itself. So with that said, you know, if we want to use the terminology blend wall, I have a blend wall, and I would imagine it's 22-24% would be my average. And for nothing more than just giving these people a choice. And when I say giving them a choice, I don't make them buy 10%. That's not my beginning gas. I give them the chance to buy ethanol-free gas. And you know what? If that's what you so choose, by all means. It certainly is your choice. The only problem I see with the so-called blend wall is the lack of the opportunity for the consumer to buy more than 10% at the pump. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I was the only game in town, and in my area, there still isn't that many people that do this sort of thing. So with that said, I don't want to be the only guy selling E15, E30, E85. The industry has been, obviously, it's been really good to me. The last few years, our little gas station pumps nearly 1 million gallons a year, excuse me, which is three times the gallons we sold prior to putting in blenders. So it really helped put us on the map. It helped us become profitable, sustainable. If you want to talk about jobs, I have 12 people on the payroll right now, which is pretty impressive compared to wondering if we're just beating our head against the wall and we're going to stay in business for another year, nearly 6 years ago when we did this. So it's not rocket science. I am an uneducated South Dakotan that just decided to do blender pumps. Kind of stumbled along the way, ran into some of the right people. So it can certainly be done. And this has, by all means, been the absolute best decision that we possibly could have made for our station. Thanks for your time.
So when you take that road trip, go to Balding, South Dakota, right? Thanks, Bruce, very well. And our next panelist is someone that I've had pleasure working with for quite some time. He's the president of Poet Ethanol Products out of Wichita, Kansas. He's very knowledgeable in all things market related to ethanol and other stuff. So please join me in welcoming Bob Castor.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I like the title of this briefing, What's Really Happening with the So-Called Blend Wall. So that gave me the topic of what my discussion is going to be about. I thought I'd start with defining the fuel distribution system and how, you know, gasoline and ethanol are produced all the way to when it goes into your fuel tank in your car, so you can kind of see how it works. And we can talk then about each of these elements and is there a blend wall at that point. If we start with production, we've got biorefineries producing ethanol, we have petroleum refineries producing petroleum, and today there is no limit around the production side of the business. We have today about 86% of the industry is operating. It used to operate at 100%. So we have capacity available to produce more ethanol today without any additional capital going into facilities. From the refining side, the components that we blend when we make gasoline with, there's no limit on the refining side of the business. So as a blend wall from a production standpoint is concerned, that doesn't exist. From there, we go into what I call the bulk transportation system. This is how everything moves from the biorefinery into the, I guess you call it the transportation to move it throughout the country. Because refineries are located on the Gulf Coast, typically, and biorefineries located throughout the Midwest, typically. It will either move by rail car, or it'll move by truck, or it'll move by pipeline. Now, when we first started with ethanol back years ago, there was no infrastructure to handle it. At that point in time, when there was E0 and we were moving to E10, the first element that we had to develop were the bulk transportation systems to allow for the product to move long distances. Well, today we have that built for E10, and if we look at the capacity that the system has today, we can move up to roughly 88 until we have to add new additional capacity on the bulk system. So there is no blend wall around this side of the business. So then what we do is we then have to break this out of the big bulk shipments that come in trucks or rail cars or pipeline. And this is where all fuel ends up going into basically trucks that get delivered into the station. Now, again, back when we were moving from E0 to E10, the bulk system did not have all the infrastructure in place. So part of our job was to build that, put in additional tank space, put in inline blending capacity over the distribution point where the fuel comes from the bulk facility into the truck. And that's in place today. And just so you know, there is no blend wall at that point because today we have the capacity to easily handle 15% alcohol. As a matter of fact, we could probably handle up to 50% alcohol through that system. So we do not have a blend wall anywhere in the infrastructure. All of these points were points of constraint when we first started moving from E0 to E10, when we solved them all. And we solved them so well that there hasn't been a fuel supply interruption because of ethanol in the history of ethanol. Yet I think you can recall every year we'll have problems with refineries. We'll have problems with pipelines. We'll have massive fuel spikes because of it. Yet we've been able to deliver 100% of the time across the entire United States a perfect solution. I see no blend wall yet. Okay, now we got the retail station, and then we go into the vehicles. On the retail side of the business, what we have is we have the ability to go into improve the infrastructure with a very small additional expense. When we first introduced the concept of E15, unfortunately, we had some rule changes that occurred after the fact, because up to that point, E15 was approved for all dispensers throughout the United States. That was sort of revisited, and now we have that issue resolved again. So for about, I think, $800 for a retrofit kit, we can go and retrofit any pump out there to go on to handle E15. It's readily available, UL approved. There's not a constraint, and the two companies that are out there that are manufacturers of pumps have those available. Now we get to the vehicle. Vehicles, since 2001, have been approved by the EPA to go and to utilize ethanol at 15%. And what we have as far as a vehicle fleet, we have about 75% of the vehicles on the road today are 2001 and newer vehicles. So we really don't have a problem anywhere along this whole value chain of moving ethanol from production to the vehicle that is a blend wall. So what is exactly the real issue around that? Because it gets kind of confusing. Here's the reality of what we're dealing with. What we have in ethanol is we have the most competitive fuel that's available in the marketplace. And that becomes a problem when the people that we're competing with have really no ability to go into compete against us on price and on quality and on value. And so what happens is we have a lot of regulations around gasoline. And we have a lot of things that are put in place for the right purpose to protect the consumer, the environment, but they never envisioned ethanol in the first place. So now I call this the regulation wall. And we're working through that. Now we have E15 available, and we're moving through all those things. But the people who are the incumbents, the people who produce the refined products from crude oil, they use those regulations as their barrier to our entry, because they know that if we enter into the marketplace, if we scale the 10% blend wall, we'll take the next 5% away from them, just like we took the first 10% away from them. Now, I was told that this is not a good chart to show because you can't see it, there's too much stuff going on. What this is our daily analysis of the competitiveness of producing gasoline from crude oil versus ethanol from, this uses corn as a feedstock. And what we're saying is we have a 70 cent a gallon advantage over a gallon of gasoline. So when a refiner is producing gasoline at zero profit, we still have 70 cents that we're competitive versus their product. Now, when I first got in the business in 1999, this wasn't known by the refining industry. Most people thought ethanol was a non-competitive fuel because it received a tax credit. So they were thinking, well, the only reason we have ethanol is there's this tax credit. Once the tax credit goes away, there'll be no more ethanol. Well, that's not true. The tax credit is gone, and ethanol is still competitive, and it's more competitive than gasoline, and it's been more competitive than gasoline. And now the problem is that we can't use that as an argument, that we have some subsidy that's out there that's artificially creating a market. What we have is real economics. Now that's the real problem that starts to cause concern for the people who are in the refining business for crude oil. This is probably a more accurate representation of what it's like when you're in the business of blending fuel. There's a $1.70 a gallon incentive to blend ethanol into the gasoline pool today. Now to me, a $1.70 a gallon is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. If we have a free and open marketplace, which I'm a proponent of, one would assume that we would see ethanol at 15% in every gasoline station in America tomorrow for $1.70 a gallon. But we don't have a free and open marketplace. That's the problem we have today. If we did, we would be able to see, just like Bruce was telling us with his facility, he's non-branded. That means he doesn't fly a oil company's banner. He's free to use whatever fuels he can bring in to offer to the consumer at the best price. But that's not the majority of the fuel out there. The majority of the fuel out there is still branded, and the brand is controlled by the refiners, and the refiners are saying, we will not allow 15% alcohol to be put in our pumps that they do not own. They just put the sign up because we don't want that fuel under our canopy. That's the real issue. And it's an issue of competitiveness. So you don't have to take my word for this. There's a company, they're independent. They're actually used by the refining industry. I think this is the first venture into doing work for anybody related to the ethanol side. They're called MathPro, out of Maryland. And what they did is they went through an economic analysis of how much does this RFS actually save the consumer? Is this a good value? Is what Bob Casper is saying up here about the relative value of ethanol today, even at 10%, is that a true statement? Could that much value be passed into the consumer through the savings in fuel? And basically what their number was, $31 billion a year at 10% ethanol. Now I have another study they did up to 30% ethanol, and that doubles this amount. This is the real issue. The real issue is competition. We want it, we want an open market, we can compete in it, and we will win. We know that the vehicles can use it, we know that we can produce it from different sources, we know that the customer wants it, and we know we offer the best value. And so in reality, that's what we're about. We grew the business to 10%, and we took all this away from the refining industry, and they didn't even know it happened because it happened so quickly. Okay, well, they woke up. Everything we did to develop 10% is the same thing we'll do to develop 15%. I did it. Our company did it. It's not hard. It's very doable. The problem is if we go and if we open that market up, as soon as we make that happen, the refining industry loses another 5%. It's all about money. Tom said it. Follow the money. And this is really what the bottom line is. So I was here to kind of give you the bottom line of what's really happening. There really isn't a blend wall created by the ethanol. There's a blend wall created by the economic threat of ethanol. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, and all the panelists. I thank you. What we gave you out here today, or what we tried to provide for you, was some of the issues and certainly the facts. Oftentimes, when you go through these debates, some people have deeper pockets and a louder megaphone, and we've certainly seen this. It's a very coordinated effort, as Bob said, to protect the market share. And so at this point, what I'd like to do is just open it up and hear from you. Any questions, comments, suggestions, criticisms, we'll take that. Give that one to Andy. He's smiling. Race predictions, football, I don't care. Whatever you want to do, just state your name and where you're from. We'll open it up. Anybody? Yes.
Hi, my name is Molly. I'm from Washington Analysis, and I was just wondering, I think my question might be for Bob. What's your take on the recent volatility in the renewable identification number market, the spiking prices, and do you think there's going to be enough cellulosic produced this year to meet the mandate?
Well, what we have is we have enough capacity to go and to meet all of the buckets of the renewable fuel standard, and that there really isn't an issue about the capacity to produce. The issue is what I just described about, which is the, I guess, the restriction that is placed on the market to not put more than 10% ethanol in the gasoline pool. So what you have today is you have the battle between the people who are trying to move ethanol into the marketplace, which is ourselves, and the industry that's opposed to seeing any more market share loss. And because they have an obligation to use more, and they're not creating enough RINs, so they have to go and buy them in the marketplace. I mean, but they're buying them for you, probably, aren't they?
They are. We sell RINs and And I guess that's something I wish I could have touched on just a little bit. When we started selling the ethanol, we started got compliant with the EPA to receive the RINs and to remarket them. You know, it's, you just use the EPA's portal as a seller and somebody's the buyer on the other end. They will, you know, had near zero value essentially for a couple of years until now this year it's gotten to be kind of a real commodity, if you will. And the only thing I have to say is, from the retailer standpoint, they need to know what a RIN is, what its value is, and how much of that should be passed along. I'm selling E85 today for $1.10 less than my E10, less than anybody even remotely close to us. And I'm sure they're wondering why, and it's because I'm passing most of that RIN right through my customer.
So the consumer's safe.
So the consumer's saving more money.
It should be noted that RIN values in 2011 were 2 or 3 cents.
The RIN really is free.
Right. Yeah, we give away those. The RIN follows the transfer of the ethanol to the buyer.
Everything we produce, the RIN goes with it at zero cost.
And if you look at last year in 2011, when RIN prices were 2 or 3 cents, we still had gas prices as high as we are. So anybody that tries to tell you gas prices are going up because of this RAND crisis, which is, as he's pointed out, self-inflicted, is this not true?
Thank you.
I'll ask if nobody else is.
Yeah.
This is for Dr. Randolph. I'm not sure if you can address it, but if you can.
Who are you with?
I'm sorry, with Iowa Renewable Fuels and my shop. We were chatting earlier about the somewhat infamous CRC study that, you know, said that, I'm not going to say it said that, but it has been portrayed on Capitol Hill that if you put E15 in a car, it's going to spontaneously explode or some such thing and at least stop working. And just wondering your thoughts on that test, how they got the cars they tested, the new test they created, and even their definition of a failure in that test. Is it a failure? You know way more about engines than probably anyone else in this room, so if you can comment on that, I'd sure appreciate it.
I'm very familiar with that test, and actually the fellow who orchestrated it from FEV, Henning Kleeberg, is a friend of mine, so I won't say too many bad things about it because he and I get along well, but I will tell you that the vehicles that were selected and the test process that was defined for that test were intended to try to make everything fail. This was not a standard industry test process for accruing miles on engines. It's not representative of how anyone would drive a car. And indeed, the engines that were selected were engines that were prone to failure in that kind of testing. There's E10 has been on the market for a long time, and there's obviously hundreds of millions of vehicles out there that have accrued trillions of miles on E10, yet the baseline for the test was not E10. None of the engines in the test were run on E10. They were all run on gasoline, and some of them didn't even live through the gasoline part. And then they ran them in AP15 and declared they had a higher failure rate. Failure being defined as not standing on the side of the road with smoke coming from under your hood or your engine looking like the one in the video I showed you. Failure was based on an arbitrary definition of a cylinder leakage parameter, which is something we use often, where you pressurize the engine, saying they're static, and you measure how quick you have leakage of the gas that you use to pressurize around the valves and around the pistons. What they defined as a failed engine is something that probably the vast majority of people in the room here wouldn't even realize that you're driving around your car, you had an engine in it that was defined as failed. It was a very tight specification on what we call a blow-by, which is a leakage spec, that isn't unusual at all for cars that accrue the kind of mileage and the duration of those tests. So certainly I would not want to read anything into those tests implying that E15 is going to be doomsday in any way for any of your cars. So does that answer your question?
Well, I appreciate your insight on that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
My name is Dave McCoy. I'm with Senator Mark Udall's office.
Uh-huh.
And Bob, this is for you, I believe. No worries. You mentioned that the traditional petroleum is using regulations geared towards the production of petroleum that are kind of slowing down and stopping ethanol production and biofuel production. Are there any particular regulations or particular sets of regulations that have been damaging to ethanol that you believe ethanol should have a different standard towards, or that have been, or what regulation do you feel like would be the best to change or remove to make it more of an even playing field?
Well, I think the one thing that was evident with the proposed Tier 3 rulemaking is that we've been working with the EPA on defining a new regulation for ethanol fuels. Because if you look at how the regulation evolved around gasoline, it evolved around gasoline with no ethanol in it. And then through waivers and other elements of change, they were able to go and introduce ethanol into a gasoline regulation. What I was talking to the EPA about, which, you know, this predates a lot of people here, in 1978, E10 was approved for fuel and vehicles. But in 2008, 30 years later, I'm still working with the southern region of the United States weights and measures on a distillation profile curve for gasoline that's different than what it would look like when you put just 10% ethanol in it. And yet we had to invest all this effort to go into fit ethanol at just 10% into a gasoline regulation. So what we've been talking to the EPA about is defining a new classification of fuel that would go and be written for the specifications that it would truly represent at more than 15% ethanol concentrations. And I think that you can see they're also allowing the engine manufacturers to go into certify their fuel, and they're looking for comments on certification fuels up to 30% alcohol. So it's not that we have bad regulation. Regulation was done based on what we were looking at 30 years ago. No one thought there was going to be any ethanol in the fuel 30 years ago. Today, now, we have the opportunity to put ethanol in the fuel at higher and higher concentrations, and we receive all the net benefits. So instead of trying to change every old rule on books, we'll go and we'll develop a new set of parameters. But all this stuff takes work. It just doesn't happen overnight. This has been 2 years, for me, 2 years is a lifetime. Maybe that doesn't seem very long, but it's 2 years that we've been working on this, and we're getting there. So I'm not disappointed. I'm just saying that the regulation is static. We're not. We're changing things, and therefore, we have to go and we have to remove those barriers as quickly as we can.
I'd just like to add one thing to that. Dr. Randolph talked about the lead in fuel, and he talked about the aromatics. And one thing the EPA could do is start working to get the aromatics out of fuel. Every time you fuel up your pump, you're breathing cancer-causing molecules. And the more biofuels you put in, the less cancer-causing molecules the public's going to be exposed to.
Well, then there's that whole element. We can talk about that quite a bit. There's a lot of reasons to use more ethanol in your fuel, other than the value. Not only is it using less carcinogens, it produces less pollution of different types, not just greenhouse gas pollution, but other types of particulate pollution. And all these are health effects items. Now, that wasn't part of this discussion, so we didn't prepare for that, but that's a very good point.
Got time for maybe one more question. Yes, sir.
Timothy Trump from Clearview Energy Partners. This question is for anyone, really. Just broadly, any views on 2013 and 2014 RFS and NIPS targets?
The volumes?
Yes,
sir. I think we're all waiting patiently for the volumes to be finalized by EPA. We've been told it's going to occur this summer. And one of the things, and I think someone else had asked a question related to it about meeting the targets. The targets have been adjusted each of the last 3 years for cellulose. And that's based upon an analysis by EPA on how much is going to be produced. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people trying to get Congress to weigh in on how you set these volume levels, which would be a really bad move. To have them trying to manage that process. EPA and DOE have a much better handle on it. But the advice I would give EPA is be realistic on actually what's going to occur. That sometimes comes back to bite us if they're not. I think EPA's done a good job with it. I think they will ultimately. It's unfortunate they've not been out before now. We had the waiver pending last year to suspend the RFS, and that drug it out, and it seemed like there weren't any new rulemakings coming out of any federal agencies until after that first Tuesday in November last year. So there was a long queue of stuff. But I think they're moving to it. As Brandon said earlier, working on the pathways. The EPA, there's enough flexibility at EPA and discretionary authority to address any of the criticisms that are out here at the RFS, period. Except for the criticism that Bob identified. They just don't want us in business. They don't want to share their marketplace. You know, we have, and I think everyone up here addressed some of the real critical issues and complaints that's out there on our industry with facts. Not made-up slogans, not PR campaigns, the real truth about what's going on. And that's why we wanted to come up here and explain this today. We want an open market. We don't have any tax credits, as Bob mentioned, for any grain-based ethanol. We're producing 10% of the nation's fuel. Now, you want to draw a comparison? Let's look over at the other side. Does oil and gas have tax breaks? They have a lot of them. They're a lot more mature than we are. You want to compare the environment, what we do, how much cleaner we are to the environment than their product? We'll do it. You want to do it on consumer cost? As Bruce pointed out, the savings to consumers and others. We'll do that comparison. You want to talk about stuff for our national security and our energy security? Just this week, the incidents in Egypt, which is not a big oil producer, but they control the Suez Canal again. The fear hits the markets, drives up prices. How many times are we going to see that movie? It's like the movie Groundhog Day. We've seen it over and over and over and over again. And we are an alternative. It's kind of like you would never put all your eggs in one basket. And we have as a nation on our fuel choice when we stick with petroleum base. We're the alternative. We're competitor. We're cheaper. We're cleaner. Thank you all for coming.